Hey, welcome back to another episode of the Motocross Training Podcast. Joel Youngkins here with you in this episode. And if you're a regular listener to my podcast, you'll kind of realize I haven't really been doing too many podcasts. It's kind of been a while since the end of Supercross season that I did in my last episode. Just kind of been busy. Also, haven't really had any new topics on my mind that I feel overly motivated to share. I feel like I've covered a lot on this podcast already. I think we're like 50 plus deep episodes, and really I've done some cool little deep dives on some different topics and try to spread some love all across the board over topics that I think you would find interesting. And but I'm always open for suggestions. If you ever want to like shoot me an email or just like DM me on social media, if you have something you want me to cover, just like, you know, don't hesitate to drop a suggestion for me. I may do it. I may not. I don't know. But if it's good, I'll do it. But, you know, just because I haven't done any podcasts, I'm not a podcaster, even though I've done podcasts before. They were cool. It seems like everybody has a podcast now. I am a coach first and foremost. I'm also a husband and father and all that great stuff. So honestly, I don't take the podcasting that seriously. I just like to come up with some thoughts. I'd like to share some information. I know a lot of people like podcasts. They get a lot from them. So I just do these as like a means to provide value for you. And hopefully just kind of give back to the sport and, a sport that's given me a lot in my life. And, you know, definitely has helped keep food on the table for my family and things like that. So this is like my way of kind of just giving back and just giving value. And hopefully you get something from this to help make your racing and preparation better. Also, you know, just like hopefully clearing up some confusion about certain topics, because there's just a lot of stuff. Like, not even just in the moto industry, there's just a lot of stuff on the internet. And hopefully we get to a point here in the future where like, man, like some like just the noise just kind of starts calming down with like information overload for you on social media, and just like the internet in general, just between ads and people trying to promote their own stuff or selling, you know, basically modern age snake oil salesmen. There's just a lot to like digest. So hopefully that's kind of why I like to do these two, just to like kind of cut through all the noise and all the salesy, gimmicks and things like that. So, I don't know. Yeah. If you've been a listener to this podcast for a while, hopefully we've been able to do that to at least some capacity for you. And yeah, let's get into today's episode. You know, this one, I just called it Thoughts Lately. And really, I got like three thoughts that I wanted to share with you. To be honest, I've probably have maybe said some of this stuff before. Maybe I've just said it differently, but like I said, I really didn't go back and like double check all my episodes if I've talked about any of this. So if I did, just like, I still think it's important if I've said, you know, things like this in the past, just, you know, listen to it again, I guess. But, yeah, we've got three things, three different thoughts, not two, not four, but three, because it has to be three. Yeah, these are just some general thoughts lately I have just surrounding all sorts of, you know, all disciplines of motocross training in regards to just overall preparation and training that just wanted to share with you here today. So let's get into it. The first thought I have is, and this one goes for like really my pro racers listening or younger racers or racers in general who are just going to, that are hopefully pursuing a pro career one day or working towards that. And it's, you don't want to be a full-time pro with a part-time commitment level. And what I mean is like, there's a lot of pros and even like A-riders that are on the cusp of like becoming pros that have an opportunity to like make a living at racing. Maybe not like a true living, but like, you know, enough to like make some money to do something with, you know, like, but they treat it like a part-time job. And what I mean by that is like, when they wake up, like if you look at someone who, if you have a full-time job, or maybe your parents have a full-time job and they wake up Monday through Friday and majority of their day and time is spent at work, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 hours. Not going to get into, like, you know, different parts of the world have different cultural ideas of what, like, a full-time job is. But in America, it's like 40 hours a week is sort of the standard. But so anywhere from like that 20 hours onward and upward is, you know, we start to kind of talk like, hey, it's pretty much like a full-time job. But for their aspect, like, they show up and, like, their day is dedicated to working. If you're a full-time, you know, just working professional, you have a job, you have to go, you make a living, you're a professional in something. Maybe you're a plumber, electrician, doctor, nurse, you get it. Like, it's a full-time thing. And a lot of racers, like, and a lot of, I mean, this is pro athletes all across the board. But a lot of racers don't treat it like that. It's just sort of like they want to be a pro with an amateur commitment level. They want to ride when they want to. They want to train when they feel motivated to. And, you know, it's like, it's one of them things where, like, I hate to brag to some people, but I have a lot of, I have some, like, vet level, senior level racers who have full-time jobs, who have families and a full plate, you know, on their table. And honestly, like, they, a lot of them take it more seriously than some of these top, than some of these pros and even just, like, pro-am, A-level riders that don't take it seriously, that actually have the talent and youth to do something. A lot of the vet senior riders, man, like, they treat it way more serious. They're way more committed than a lot of the pros. And they just do it for fun, and it's more of an outlet for them on the weekend. That or to race for a wooden plaque to win some races. But no, all jokes aside, like, it is for real. It can be quite lopsided. And it's just a reminder, like, hey, are you approaching, if you want to be a full-time pro with a part-time mentality, it's not going to cut it. If you're taking that approach, either your full-time racing approach, if you're already there and you're treating it like a part-time, you're going to lose those opportunities soon. Like, it's not going to last long. If you are like an A rider, or you're just someone who, hey, I'm on track to become a pro, I think I could do this, but you're not taking it serious, you're not revolving most of your day around riding, whether that could be riding your bike, bike prep, training, watching film, endless recovery work, working on your nutrition, making sure you're sleeping good. Like, that's what I mean by a full-time approach. Like, you're doing all the things you need to be doing, not just riding for 12 hours a day. Like, no one, you know, nobody does that, but, and maybe some people do, I don't know, but, you know, you're not riding your dirt bike all day long. You're just doing things to become a better racer. And if you're not, like, if you're becoming a pro or you're on that track, start making it like a full-time job now, or at least a full-time mentality, I should say. Because I understand you may be in school, you might have a job to support your racing and things like that, but the mentality has to be full-time. And if it's not, then it's okay to just say you want to race and ride for fun. That's totally cool too. Just don't get it twisted, and don't waste people's time if that's not where your head's at. All right, let's go to thought number two. And this kind of comes in mind with, you know, I just talked to my one racer, Jeremy Hand. He just finished up like 20th or whatever in the 450 class for the Super Motocross. And, you know, we started talking about Supercross, you know, next year. This is just a conversation like we had, I think, last week. And, you know, after Super Motocross was done, he just got done with Supercross. He did East Coast Supercross in 2023. Then he did 450 Outdoors and then 450 Super Motocross. And so he had a full year. It was good. Things went really good. He's number 56 for next year. And, you know, we just had a nice little conversation about, like, you know, he's just been riding. He hasn't stopped. He hasn't stopped training. He still comes to the gym. He took like a week off from the gym. You know, and about 7 to 10 days later, he's back in the gym. He's riding. His riding right now is not really structured. It's just sort of riding. It's just kind of staying on the bike. He's not at a Supercross track pounding out laps right now. He has time till he races. He's probably going to pick up the 450. I don't want to speak for him right now. Not that it's like a top secret, but he's probably going to start racing Supercross at Detroit, which will be like beginning of February. So there's a little bit of time, but right now he's just letting his body just rest and heal from last year while working on his body to start prepping for next year. But he's staying on the bike, but he's just riding right now. Like, we live in Ohio, so that's where he's still at right now before he goes south to ride Supercross. But right now he's just staying on the bike. He's having fun. He's riding with some buddies. My one quad racer, Cole Richardson, he got a dirt bike, and they've been riding dirt bikes together, doing some trail riding, riding at different tracks. Again, nothing structured, just having fun, just staying on the bike. And so what that thought kind of occurred to me for this episode is, a lot of people treat training and racing, like the whole process, it's either like an on or off switch for them. And training is never, it shouldn't ever be looked at as an on off switch. It should be looked at as like a dial. So either you want to, you know, as the season gets closer, you start cranking that dial up. And, you know, that dials, you know, you keep building that dial up until you're in the season and then you're in full race mode where everything's just go, 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 go the whole time. When the year is done racing or the season's done, you start to turn that dial back down. And that's all it is. You just turn it down a little bit. You don't turn all the way off. You just start to back it down. And you just bring down the intensity. You bring down the volume. And then when it's time to get ready for the next season, you start turning it back up. A lot of racers are either all in or they're all out. And what happens when you do this is, like, when you go from racing to you stop everything and you stop training, you stop riding, it creates harsh transitions. And your body does not like harsh transitions in either direction, whether you're turning it off or you're turning it back on. You need to have some smooth transitions out of high volume and high intensity phases and kind of ease out of the season. And then you need to ease back into prepping for the next season. And if you do create these harsh transitions, when you do get back into it and we're like, okay, I'm ready to get ready for Supercross, they could take you, excuse me, anywhere from 2 to 6 weeks to start feeling good again, depending on how long and how off that break was. So whereas, like, if you're someone that's just turned the dial back down, like what we're doing with Jeremy right now, he's just staying on the bike, just practicing, having fun, riding. When he gets back into Supercross, it just may take him like a few sessions, and he'll be feeling back to his self that he was at Super Motocross. And then he can start building for next year and hopefully improving on his skills he had from last year versus just starting back and just trying to get back, like starting from ground zero and trying to get back to baseline for the first race. And then you're in the same exact spot. That's, you know, the point of training is to get yourself better, become something you weren't last year. And when you play with just turning the dial, you know, up or down, you have that opportunity to have the time. You have more time on your side to actually get ready. So yeah, that's really point number two. Okay, and so for my third and final thought, because I've only had three thoughts recently. Just three. No more, no less. hope you're finding the sarcasm funny. Just as funny as I am. Okay, so for my third point for the podcast today is, if you think about all of the best racers, and I can think of a couple right now, Ricky Carmichael and James Stewart, they went, let's just say, 24-0. We just had Jet Lawrence went 22-0 over the summer. When you start to look at like the best to ever swing a leg over a bike, whenever they have done those feats, they have all had trainers and or trainers and coaches. They didn't do it alone. And what's interesting with this is, you know, the reason why they do this, like, they're good. Like, Jet probably could have did this by himself, probably with him, his dad, and his team, and probably still have won the championship. But probably with some extra help, probably really just sealed the deal and made it a little bit easier to go 24-0 or 22-0. It gives them the – so when elite-level athletes, like the top-level athletes, like when they have a coach or a trainer, whatever you want to call, whether it's a riding coach or a trainer like myself, it gives them the edge, accountability, and it frees up mental space so that they can pour more into their craft versus themselves having to make these decisions. These decisions become emotional. So, you know, say Ricky Carmichael didn't have the best moto. He almost got beat, we'll say. He may go back the next week because emotionally he may be upset with that. He may have really just overworked and ran himself into the ground or did things that he usually doesn't do versus just sticking to the plan and chalking it up as, hey, that was a little bit of an off day. Coaches and trainers allow you to stay the course and to basically stay out of your own way, which is super important the more competitive you are as a racer. So if you're a good racer yourself, you know, you're highly competitive. You're not just highly competitive on race day. You're highly competitive all the time. You know, just like your mechanic, if you have a mechanic, coaches and trainers, they allow you to just stay the course. They just let you do what you do best and hopefully make, and hopefully just allow you to double down on yourself. So even like if you think you have good fitness levels now, having a trainer will only make it better. And I think that's kind of a misconception. You know, a lot of people are like, oh, you know, my fitness is good. I can run a mile in this and I can do this many push-ups. I can do this many pull-ups. I deadlift this much. My VO2 max is, you know, a certain number and I feel really good about that. That's all really good. I love it. But, you know, the job of the trainer isn't just to give you good numbers to hang your hat on. The process of a trainer is to obviously build you up to do what you need to do, but it's also about managing the process for you throughout the whole entire race season. It is to basically allow you to say, hey, I am in really good shape. That is one of my strengths. I want to make my strength even better. So I hire a coach to do it even better. You don't want your strength to just become, to be just good enough. You want your strength to really shine and to really like lock it in as like, no, I am in good shape, but like, I want to be better. I want to make sure it's the best. That's what really good athletes do. They're obsessed about getting better. So, you know, I've had a lot of racers come to me and they're already in pretty good shape. And to me, I'm like, okay, cool. Like I don't have to worry. I don't have to stress about just improving their overall fitness. They have a decent base of fitness. Now it's just, let's get them on a better plan and let's just like help them manage this whole process, manage their stress, help them make decisions, take the weight of their guessing what to do off their shoulders. And let's just give them a more solid plan. Let's execute it better and fill in any little holes that they may have that they can't see themselves. That's really the idea of having a trainer and or, you know, even a riding coach. Not that I'm a riding coach, but same thing. So it's, and you know, like if you're a racer and your fitness levels are just god awful, like you just don't have any fitness level, you just ride your bike and you're just out of shape. That's actually tougher to hire a coach, to be honest. A lot of people look at it backwards where they're like, oh man, I'm so out of shape. I need to hire a trainer. And, you know, you can obviously do that, but it's going to take longer to you know, probably at least a year, maybe more for some people to really build up true levels of fitness to where you're really good. It's going to take at least a good hard year of work and nobody is exempt from that. So what I'm trying to say is if you're already in good shape and you're on the fence, like, hey, man, maybe I should hire a trainer. If you're already in good shape, just do it because, like, you don't have to, like, build that whole year up of actually getting yourself in shape. You're already ready to go. Now it's just time to, okay, let's just dial things in for you. Let's just get a good solid plan. Boom, let's take off and run with this. And you can kind of cut out that whole, like, year of just, like, oh, let's just get in shape first. And then we can really start training, you know, a year or so later. So just kind of like two different situations there for like two different situations for two different racers and two different like expectations, I should say. Hopefully you're following along with that and what my point was. But yeah, like if you have good fitness levels now, they can be better. Just like your riding skills on your bike, your riding skills could be better. If you're not beating Jet Lawrence or Chase Sexton or Eli Tomac right now, you can get better. So always room for improvement. And probably the last note is, I don't know what like the general consensus is of what people feel like, if trainers are like cost effective or like they don't have to be, like if you, everybody thinks all the trainers are crazy expensive because they've kind of heard what maybe a guy like Eldon Baker charges. I kind of want to break down some of that stuff for you and kind of just explain why, kind of how the whole like market works in motocross training in that realm. So like working with someone like myself, listen, I'm not cheap, but I'm really affordable when it comes to coaching. I have more expensive options, of course, but for my general across the board coaching, I'm very affordable. And I do that for long-term relationships and development. I don't like to bleed my clients dry. I could certainly charge a lot more for my services than what I do. And that's why I have different levels of my coaching available. But for the most part, like I have a huge list of racers and three other categories of clientele I work with on a daily basis. And it's all people that I work with long-term. Like I was just talking about Jeremy Hand. I've worked with Jeremy Hand for over 10 years now. And I've worked with a lot of my racers for multiple years. Like we go way back. Quinn Wenzel, I think we're coming up on like 5 years, 4 or 5, 6 years. He's a professional hard enduro racer. I can kind of go on and on. Same with a lot of my other clients. I have long-term working relationships with them. And I do that because training is a long-term approach, and I like to work with my clients long-term so that I can actually give them the real experience versus like, and I have no problem with this, it's just a certain model, but like there's a classical, you know, personal training studio where you work one-on-one with a personal trainer, and like their model is a little different to where, you know, you sign up usually anywhere from like 8 to 12 week sessions. They try to like package it in, and honestly, it's like, it's because it's one-on-one, they charge a lot, you know, it could be anywhere from $50 to $100 an hour to work with a personal trainer. But really what they're doing is they're trying to get the most out of you and like the most amount of money out of you in like 12 weeks. And they're trying to package it up so that you do 12 weeks and they know that they're probably going to lose you as a client. And, you know, you will, and hopefully maybe if you got deep pockets, you'll come back and spend the money again. And that's sort of like, that's one model, and that's okay. That's not a bad thing. It's not what I do. You know, so that's one category. So like not all motocross trainers are also going to charge those prices because we don't like, I don't want to say more skilled, but that's not what I mean. But we're able to work with more people than just yourself. So, that helps the affordability options of where your price point could be at. And so, you know, it may not be that far out of reach from what you really think it is. You know, do you want to pay $10 a month? No, that's called Planet Fitness. But it should be some sort of investment, but it should be something that is affordable long-term in my mind. Now, when you hear about like factory level trainers like Eldon Baker, you know, we'll use Eldon Baker. He is, you know, he has the most championships. He's worked with, you know, a lot of the best racers. Let's just sort of like, we'll use him as the kind of like marquee example. He's the one that's talked about the most. You know, so when you hear about his pricing, like numbers have been thrown around of, you know, he makes anywhere from like, you know, like to work with him, it's like anywhere from like 200,000 on up. I mean, 250. I mean, you know, let's just say multiple, you're well into the six figures to work with Alton Baker. I don't know the exact numbers. I've just heard numbers thrown around. And honestly, good for him. That's awesome. plus, he only works with a couple guys that makes that much money. It's great. But, like, you have to understand that when, you know, his style of coaching, when he works with a Ricky Carmichael, a Ryan Villopoto, a Ryan Dungy, his clientele does not want to pay normal prices that everybody else. And their model of training is a little different where, you know, he's with them one-on-one pretty much all week, Monday through Friday, all day long, travels with them in the races. So yeah, like, it's going to be more expensive to do that, but you know, how that kind of works to where he can charge those prices is, you know, if you go all the way back to probably when he first started training Ricky Carmichael, all the way back in the early 2000s, if I had to guess what happened, you know, when before trainers really were like a big thing, Ricky probably, I think he got introduced to Alton Baker, like a friend of a friend kind of thing. And I believe probably if I had to guess, this is just my own guesstimation, Ricky probably was like, hey, train me and I'll give you whatever I make for the year, I'll give you a percentage of it. They probably did some sort of percentage deal the first year. And you know, Alton probably made well over six figures doing that. And he was like, man, this is pretty awesome. I could work with one client and make more than six figures a year. I would have probably done the same thing. And so he works with Ricky, makes probably whatever money they have made in arrangements, whatever that was through his career. And then after the fact, James Stewart wants to hire him. James Stewart's probably like, hey, how much do I, you know, is it to work with you a year? Well, since Ricky paid him X amount, his price point became whatever that number was. So, you know, he obviously, you can't work backwards. Like, that just becomes the standard because, so that just kind of becomes the standard of, you know, let's just say Ricky was paying him $250,000 a year to train him to win his championships and become the GOAT. You know, if that's his price point, then Ricky retires and then James Stewart comes to Alton Baker and is like, hey, I want to hire you. How much is it? At that point, you can't go back and be like, all right, I'll just charge you $100,000. You know, because he's established his worth. That's his value. That's what it is to work with him. So my point is like, there are exceptions to the rules where like not every trainer is trying to charge you like thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars that you probably don't think you have. Look, it just might not be that far out of reach for different coaching options. There's always different levels to the game. So, and I also kind of want to make the point too, and this isn't, you know, Alton does a great thing he has going on. I also want to make it clear that if you do know of like coaches, let's say of like Alton, that you're like, oh man, they charge this much just to work with him. It's not that their expertise are worth that much. And I'm not saying this as a means to discredit anybody. It's just sort of like where they've positioned themselves in the field to be worth that much. It's, you know, Alden's style of coaching is, I'm in Florida, I work with one or a couple elite level racers, I work with you however many hours a week, I travel with you to the races, I do this, I'm your guy. But he's only working with a couple people. It's very elite, it's very exclusive. That's just the ballpark he's playing in. And to do that, there is only one way to do it. And he's doing it right as far as, a business reason goes. He's giving them the attention that those racers need. But it's not like that all across the board. So I also want to just kind of use that as like an educational experience of just like, he's expensive because of what he's, the time and what he's giving to his racers is that much. is why he is the price versus like, hey, he's got some secret stuff going on and you got to pay this much because there's a bunch of secrets and only Elden knows these things and nobody else knows them. It's not like that at all. So I just wanted to like maybe use that as like an educational way to kind of break down the industry, that there are different levels. You know, myself personally, I have different levels of coaching options that go from pretty dang affordable, I'd say, to also at a much higher price point for more time and more value as well. But yeah, there are different levels to the game, depending on if you have more money to spend or less money. There's options out there for you. It's not just, hey, I'm gonna hire somebody, they're gonna bleed me dry, and that's the end of the game. So that's really it. Those are my only three thoughts I've had recently. But yeah, I just want to drop in, make a you know, an episode here and share some more content, some more value, some more thoughts, some more ideas, and hopefully all is well. If you need anything, don't hesitate to ask. You can reach me out through email. You can find that on my website, social media, wherever. And yeah, let me know if there's anything I can do for you. And until next time, keep riding, stay safe, and train hard.